Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, a special podcast edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And Clay, I thought it might be good to take this Sunday prior to the elections to talk to the listeners about the importance of voting, about the importance of the election, not to endorse anyone or guide anyone to a certain type of vote, but to vote.
David, it's not, you know, it's not clear what the Jeffersonian answer is to the election of 2008. Ron Paul is closer to Thomas Jefferson than either of the two main party candidates. Jefferson would be a fiscal conservative. I guess that's John McCain. But he would share Barack Obama's view of our place in the world, that we need a humbler foreign policy and that we need to stop pretending that we won't talk with nations who disagree with us and that we can dictate power at the end of a cruise missile. On the other hand, I think Jefferson would be appalled by the idea that the national government would take over health care or would have an expanded role in the economy. It's impossible to say what a Jeffersonian should do in the election of 2008, and that's certainly not our purpose. Our purpose is to clarify rather than to dictate terms or to pretend that we understand how Jefferson might see the world in our time. But I do think that we're at a crossroads as a nation, and that this really is probably the most important election of our time, because it's going to determine what the early 21st century looks like for the United States. And we're either going to be a nation that moves towards a more European model of itself, that would be, I think, Barack Obama, or we're going to continue to be a Reagan-esque nation, which is strong, skeptical of government, committed to lower taxation, at least for the wealthiest citizens of this country, and committed to the privatization of the essential functions of life. So people do have a pretty stark choice. And, you know, it'll be very interesting to see how it comes out. Everything that I've read, you tell me what you're seeing, is that the voter turnout is going to be unprecedentedly high. And it looks to me as if it's not going to be a tie. You know, the last two elections have effectively been a tie, especially the election of 2000, and they've led to a legitimacy crisis. This time I think that there's going to be a clear-cut winner. And even if that upsets the people from the other side, I think we're all going to sigh in relief on Wednesday when we realize that the country has spoken and it has decided who the next president is.
I think it's very interesting to look at how the process of this election has evolved. You know, 6 months ago, we would have said, well, the war is going to be the defining issue. And as we know, it's become the economy. But I'm interested to know what you think about, you know, this call that Barack Obama is leading in the polls, and it's almost an act of we throw up our hands and say, well, nothing else works. Let's try the new kid and see something different.
Well, I think it's good that, I remember, I'm just old enough to remember the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans. That was John Kennedy's mantra when he became president of the United States in 1960. And here we have a young, dynamic man who is Kennedy-esque in many respects, calling on America to be a nobler, more idealistic, in a sense, nonpartisan nation that has a more humble place in the world's arena. Whether he actually can make that stick is another question. John Kennedy was not a particularly successful president. He's been enormously successful as a memory of a president, and a great deal occurs that is in which John Kennedy's name is invoked. But he actually wasn't a particularly successful president, and of course he didn't get a chance to finish out his work. I don't know whether Barack Obama is going to win the election or not, but I do think very strongly that the war should be a bigger issue than it is. I mean, whoever the next president of the United States is come Wednesday, that person is going to have to extricate us from this war. Either we're going to wind up spending 20 or 30 more or 50 more years there to stabilize the region and to create the conditions under which stability can allow the oil to flow freely towards the West, or we're going to have to withdraw sometime in the next 4 years. And we know from our past experience, particularly Vietnam, that these withdrawals are agonizing things. They're agonizing for us because they signify national defeat and degradation, but they're even more agonizing for the nations we leave behind. And, you know, the so-called surge has appeared to work, although what I'm reading suggests to me that it's not so much the surge, it's just a weariness in Iraq, you know, that they just spent a lot of their violent energy there and now there's kind of a truce. But if the surge did work, that doesn't mean that we're leaving the country any better than we found it, in fact, infinitely worse. And the surge may be an illusion we've created to allow us to withdraw with a sense that we haven't utterly failed here. But I don't know how you feel, David, but I come away from this epic from 2003 to 2008, this 6-year cataclysm in the Middle East, feeling less happy about my nation and less happy about our place in the world and really somber about America. I don't know about you. You tell me. No part of me feels happy that there is a temporary lowering of violence in Baghdad.
I question whether or not it's the surge that worked, listening to Bob Woodward, who has had unprecedented access to the White House. They say it is not so much the surge as an introduction of what they refer to, I think, as special tactics.
That doesn't sound good.
But evidently it's working. The war is such a huge issue, and I agree with you that it's going to be very difficult for whoever occupies the White House to extricate us from that situation. And then, of course, there's so many other things to deal with, healthcare and the economy. The optimistic side of me would hope that whoever walks in there is going to have a cleansing breath, a clearing phrase. Now, look, folks, this is what we're – he's going to start from scratch and hopefully be able to generate some optimism in the citizens of the nation and start somewhat fresh and have a chance, be it McCain or Obama. Now, Obama's going to have the edge between the two in that sense because he is – so new and different, or at least it is portrayed that way. But you tell me, do you think that a new president is going to be able to bring the optimism of the nation up?
Yes and no. I saw Oliver Stone's film the other night, and you know what struck me about it, actually it's quite a sympathetic portrait of George W. Bush. But what struck me about the film is how much power the president has. In the end, on all these questions, somebody has to decide. You know, these are impossible questions. Do you stay or do you leave? Do you launch a war or do you continue United Nations negotiations? Do you bail out the mortgage industries and the American banks or do you let the market prevail and the chips fall where they may? Do you advocate America's place in the global conversation about climate change, or do you stand aloof? The president is surrounded by hundreds and even thousands of advisors, and Congress has its committees, and there are think tanks in Washington, and there's media, and there are great newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post that weigh in on every subject. So there's no end of debate. But in the end, it's a Tuesday morning and somebody has to decide, do we launch cruise missiles against Baghdad or do we not? Somebody has to decide, am I going to sign that bill or am I going to veto it? somebody decides, and that person gets a lot of help. You know, even the best presidents, like Franklin Roosevelt, are utterly dependent upon the men and women who work under them. But in the end, someone has to say, go, we're doing it, or we're not. Yes, no. Somebody has an up or down vote on things, and that person is the president of the United States. And what struck me was just how much power we give to this individual and how little we really debate the kind of person we're putting into that position. It's a little bit what Mrs. Clinton was doing with those awful 3 a.m. telephone call ads. I hated those ads. I think those are demagogic and they're arguably even racist. But she's right about one thing. In the end, the buck does stop there, and the president has to make extremely difficult decisions. And from what I've seen, both candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, are, to my mind, better read, better educated, more thoughtful, more deliberative, more reflective people than the current occupant of the White House. I think we are going to be better off with either of these two candidates because I think that both of them, in a sense, are CEOs who know how to process materials and information to make hard decisions. They're very different types of people and they have extremely different types of policies, but I believe that John McCain might have launched the war against Iraq. Frankly, I doubt it. But if he had, he would have prosecuted the war, I think, more intelligently than George Bush has prosecuted the war. And I think that Barack Obama, for the American taste, David, he might be too cerebral. He might be too bookish. He might be too analytical for America. We like people who work from the gut a little more than he seems to work. There's a little bit of intellectual aloofness in Barack Obama. I actually think that's going to be good for America if he's the next president. But I feel very optimistic that if the presidency is basically bringing whatever you can to bear on extremely hard questions, that we are going to do much better over the next 4 or 8 years than we've done over the last 8. What do you think?
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the rest of this year. And I would say, above all, I so look forward to hearing what Mr. Jefferson has to say about the new president and the new administration. And I suspect he will provide us all with some terrific insight.
Well, you know, Jefferson, let's talk a little bit about what we do on this program. And Jefferson can provide some insight, but only from his time and his place. And when Jefferson was president of the United States between 1801 and 1809, he had a staff of one. You know, he had a White House staff of one. He'd hire these young men from Virginia, William Burwell, probably pronounced Burl, and Meriwether Lewis and others, and he would hire these young men, and they would come live with him in the White House, which wasn't finished. It didn't have steps, and the plaster was still not finished, and it was just a kind of a shell of a house that was in early stages of its development. Jefferson wasn't a particular fan of the White House. He had actually submitted his own design for what became the president's house, and it would have been a red brick domed sort of thing. He's not a big fan of James Hoban's White House, and it's unfinished, and it's sort of clunky, and it's in the middle of a muddy field. And one of the Federalists, Gouverneur Morris, said every member of Congress, without a single exception, hates Washington, D.C., this new capital. So Jefferson's sort of the serene, agrarian, Enlightenment philosopher who happens to be president of the United States, living in this sort of godforsaken wilderness in an unfinished house with a staff of one. And he's administering the government of the United States with breathtaking efficiency. Jefferson was a born administrator, and he's a great conciliatory figure as president. He writes graceful, elegant letters to everybody, and he has very informal but really intelligent relations with his Congress, and he defers to the states wherever possible. And his view is that America is just a quiet little place where farmers and scientists will live and the world can afford to leave us alone. So, yes, we can get insights from Thomas Jefferson, but Jefferson was not a president in any meaningful sense the way presidents are presidents today, where the pressures are unbelievably large and the staff. You know, the president of the United States today never meets most of the people who make him look good. The president is utterly dependent upon group after group of people who are working 24 hours a day, essentially, to make his trip to Butte, Montana work, or to make the little summit that he's going to hold on relations with Quebec a success. And the president, in some sense, just shows up. I've had the chance to meet a couple of presidents, and one time I was at an award ceremony in the White House where the senior George Bush was present, and you know, we had been told of his schedule, and he had this impossibly detailed schedule for that day. And he had met with different groups, and he had high-level meetings, and he was talking about foreign policy, and he was meeting with congressional leaders. And then suddenly he was doing this sort of ceremonial thing, and the door opened to this room, and he walked in. And as he walked in, David, an aide handed him a script. I mean, literally handed him a script. And the president probably, as he was walking from the Oval Office to this room, said, "Now what am I doing? Huh? What? You know what? What's this?" And then somebody said, "Oh, this is the National Endowment for the Humanities thing." And he said, "Do I know who's the head of the agency? Is that this Lynn Cheney?" And he, you know, so he's probably doing a lot of scrambling. I do a lot of this in my own life. Someone says, "Don't worry, Mr. President. What you're going to do here is you'll meet five people and their families, and Lynn Cheney will be here. She'll say a few remarks, and here's what you say." And they hand him a script, and he walks in, and he looked at that script, and he was kind of puzzling over it because he literally was doing this cold, and then I made eye contact with him. I was sitting in the first row, and I made eye contact with him. I'd met him once before, just very briefly, but of course he didn't know who I was. Of course not. But I made eye contact with him, and he winked at me like, "See how it works?" You know, it's like, I walk in here, someone hands me a script, it looks really pretty.
Must have been a great moment.
And after this, I walk out, and now I have a meeting with Brent Scowcroft, or now I walk out and I have a meeting with Donald Rumsfeld, and then later I meet the Boy Scouts of America, and then the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders are coming in for a photo op, and then it's a dinner with the Japanese delegation. And the president is, in some sense, any president, even someone as engaged as Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton, is in some sense a person who's being walked through highly staged scenarios by an expert staff of people whose whole life it is to make that moment work. They probably had two people who had worked for a month on this little National Endowment for the Humanities event, and there probably were people who worked for 6 months on the dinner with the Japanese delegation. And so the president does this, and every president is utterly dependent upon these handlers. And the president, I mean, how does the president have any reading time? How does the president have any reflective time? Philosophical conversation time, time with his wife and children, time in nature, time doing the things that we all need to do to reflect on the world. The president is just, in some sense, a puppet that's being rushed through hundreds and thousands of photo ops and meetings per year. And the, you know, Condoleezza Rice will say to the president, you know, "We're not going to be able to keep Colin Powell on board unless he has an hour with you this afternoon." And the president will say, "I don't want to talk to Colin Powell. I know what he thinks. I know what he's going to say. He's going to work me over. You know, I've already made my decision. Why do I want to talk with him?" And she says, "Well, you got to." And he says, "Well, yeah, but we've got this and this and this and this. I'm supposed to go to see my daughter's soccer match." And they say, "Well, you got to do it." He's mad. And so the president winds up doing hundreds of things per month that he doesn't want to do because they're things that have to be done. And then he walks into his office and he's thinking, "You know, I have 20 minutes before I have to meet the brass band from the University of Idaho." And someone says, "You know what? You got to call Putin. Putin's about to invade this country. You got to put in a call to him right now."
You're painting kind of a grim picture here.
But
Mr.
it's true,
Jameson.
David. This is what happens. It happens to a governor. To a certain extent, it happens to a mayor or a United States senator, but to a very, very, very large extent, it happens to a president, where he is literally a beleaguered figure who is gasping for air, trying to get some time to step back and think about the world, and someone's always putting in front of him a telephone that he has to answer or a meeting that he has to take or a ceremony that he has to keep, we haven't created a presidency that really works. And I remember a friend of mine who was that I knew in Reno, Nevada, who was an expert on Asia. He said that the Chinese emperor in classical Chinese culture did nothing. He would sit for weeks at a time in a quiet room, and nothing would happen. He'd just sit there reflecting and musing. And then he would say, you know, he'd be there for 5 weeks doing absolutely nothing. And then he would say, "We will build a wall to keep the barbarians out." And then he'd go quiet for another year. And that, you know, that's a deliberative process in another culture. But in our culture, we have an incredibly hectic deliberative process. So to compare Thomas Jefferson, who probably, as president, who worked very hard, he says he worked very hard, but he probably read more than any president in American history while sitting, except possibly Theodore Roosevelt. And to compare him in a 3-mile-per-hour world with people who live today where something somewhere is always going wrong and it's brought to the president's attention and he has to fix it to the extent that he can, is probably just, I mean, literally comparing apples to oranges or the medieval world to the modern world.
Well, you talk about these gentlemen and their busy schedules and the many things that they have to do. And I, sir, am looking at the clock on the wall, and you have planes to catch, miles to drive, symposiums to conduct. And I, on behalf of the podcast audience, I want to thank you for just taking a few minutes to come in and talk to them about the election this week. And perhaps next week we can take some time to talk about what you've been up to, the symposiums that you've been involved with, because I'm certain our listeners would like to hear that.
I'd be happy to. I want to apologize for the past few weeks, this really since midsummer when we've just been, as you know,
doing good work.
Unbearably busy with the production of our first film, which, by the way, is now available, the film called The Legacy of Art Link, When the Landscape is Quiet Again. We've had to do some repeat broadcasts of the Jefferson Hour. We're out of that zone now, and we're back in the saddle, to use a Rooseveltian term. But just one more word on the election.
Please.
Here's what I feel, and you know, I do feel we are going to be better off because it's always good when the nation steps back and decides, when it reflects, when the people get engaged, and this election has engaged people in an unprecedented way. And we do have a good choice this time. We have a good choice, and you know it's a choice. This is not Walter Mondale and George Bush Sr., kind of two nice guys, both of whom are centrists. We have a young, dynamic man who's view of government is a very liberal view of government, and who argues strenuously against the foreign policies that have characterized the last 8 years in American history. And we have an elderly statesman who is also clearly a maverick and a man of great has a great story and is well known for his sort of crabby integrity, but he is a militarist. And he has won the nomination in his party by moving himself dramatically towards the right wing of the Republican Party. And so with respect to the Supreme Court, taxation, foreign policy, health care, on the major issues that really matter to the American people, there is a fairly stark choice about the future of this country. And that's going to be a very interesting thing to see. And my last word on this, David, is that I've been watching the debates and I have lost a lot of respect for both of them. The bickering, you know, neither one of them needed to descend to bickering. And I sort of forgive it in John McCain because this is his last chance. Either now he's going to be the president or he is never going to be the president. But I have been really profoundly disappointed to see Barack Obama take the bait. I would have hoped in those debates when McCain was saying wild and irresponsible things about him that Barack Obama would just say, you know, John, you can go on and on as long as you want. I'm not going to do it. I want to talk about the future of this country. But he too, Obama, descended to sort of tit-for-tat bickering and policy wrangling and saying you're lying about my record and the whole thing it disillusioned me because I'm not sure that I'm a Barack Obama fan, but the one thing I believed about him was that he was something new under the sun. And I still think that in some part, but mostly I think he's just a slightly better version of the same old thing. And that really upsets me.
Well, my last word would be to encourage everyone to vote. I've heard in the early voting that there are record turnouts. I would really encourage everyone to vote.
In my beloved Virginia, David, it said that there might be a 90% turnout.
Isn't that something?
I mean, think of it. I mean, every election cycle we have the postmortem where they say, only 42% voted. What's wrong with this country? Well, this time we're going to have a really serious vote. I think it's going to be an exciting night, Tuesday night.
Well, with that, sir, say goodbye to our podcast audience. This, as I said earlier, is a special message just for our podcast listeners, and we certainly appreciate all of our listeners and thank them for tuning in.
We'll see you after the election. I'm sure there will be surprises.